Hola, eso. So I've often spoke of Dharma. In fact, it's a very common metaphor throughout the Buddhist tradition. The reference to Dharma as being like food, the type of nourishment, which it quite clearly is. And so what we have here is, I'm running a fast food cafe. You can see how fast I speak. You know it's got to be fast food. And it's a very short time that we're here, just 8 weeks, you know. That's just kind of dropping in, chowing down a little bit, and you're on the way again. When the 8 weeks is gone, then it's like you just dropped in and you're right out again. You're like, were we really there? And so, but in fast food joints, fast food restaurants, they often have daily specials. And so I have to give you a daily special. Something cooked up. A combination plate. They're quite common, yeah? So you already have some combination plates, and I think, you know, many of you found them quite tasty. Nourishing, balancing earth and wind. It's good, yeah? It's good, Danny, yeah, good. Balancing earth and sky, very nice, you know? And so I'd like to introduce a fresh dish I've never served before. And it has a different name, of course, has to. And it's going to be balancing earth and space. And now we get, so it's fun to have a little name. Now let's put some content, a referent to the word. When you're attending to, as Padmasambhava said, observe your mind, observe your mind. You're doing something. How can you say you're not doing something? He just said, he didn't say, don't do. He said, do. Observe your mind. Quit whining. Remember? Quit whining. I can't. What do you mean you can't? Observe your mind. Right? So it's good. I mean, this is from Padmasambhava himself. That is clearly, that's pointing out instruction. There's no question about that. And so that's a way of really doing something, not much, but turning away from all appearances and observing the mind that is aware of all appearances, observing the mind that is thinking, observing the mind that is meditating. So it's a very powerful method, and he is one of many Dzogchen masters who teaches it. At the same time, we have this other approach. This other approach is just this not doing anything, now just choksha, just means just resting. Those are clearly not quite the same thing. So I think I mentioned yesterday, but I'll reiterate because it is an important point. And that is, if you had teachings, you know, if you've had the preparation, you're well into the current, you're well into the flow, you're in the context of Vajrayana Buddhism, you know about the common preliminaries, uncommon, the teaching of the bodhicitta, teachings on emptiness and so forth, and then some teachings on the Dzogchen view, if you've had of that, and your practice is imbued, your way of practicing, viewing reality, a way of conducting yourself is imbued with the bodhicitta, some understanding of emptiness, some degree of shamatha, some degree of vipassana, then if you do that, if within that context, then if you followed exactly what Padmasambhava said, and bear in mind that's something like, I don't know, chapter 15 or something, you know, it's well deep into the text, where we've covered a lot of territory already, that's where it's being placed, that is Dzogchen meditation. You're turning inwards, but it's imbued with this whole context, this richness of momentum that you bring to that practice, which frankly is very different than if you just, you know, were pulled off the street and somebody said, hey, observe your mind, I'll show you how. And with no context at all, you just did it. The technique would be the same. The technique is pretty simple, but the practice would be different. Okay? So there's that. But then we have methodologically this other route. It's again very much yang, yin yang. And the other one is about as yin as it gets. Don't do anything at all. And so, but just very briefly now with kind of one sentence, the difference of that observe your mind, turn your awareness inwards upon itself, whether that's a shamatha practice or whether it's a vipassana practice or whether it's a Dzogchen practice, it can be any of the three. Same technique. All depends on what it's imbued with, you know. So there we have that. But then methodologically we see the practice of just letting be, that just resting, cho-sha, let it be, just resting, open presence. It's a different method. It is a different method. And they're both absolutely bona fide, authentic practices that have delivered good results for a very long time now. So I could like to get to the meditation very quickly here. We have a lot to do. It could be another intense evening. What I'd like to do is balancing earth and space. So sky suggests that more of that shamatha practice. And it's balancing two modes of shamatha practice, mindfulness of breathing, and then the awareness of awareness, shamatha without a sign, balancing earth and sky, and good. Good. Because you do have something to attend to. You are aware of the cognizance and the luminosity. And that's enough. That's enough. You've arrived. You're doing it. Good. That will take you right down to the substrate consciousness, right? But now when we're doing that same practice in this context, it becomes either a Vipassana practice, if you're really bringing those questions in, that array of questions and that lovely bouquet of citations that he drew on, or if you're going into, if it's couched within the Dzogchen view, all these teachings on the nature of pristine awareness, the same method then is a Dzogchen practice. So, what I'd like to do now though, starting momentarily, is to pretty much, I'll do it, I'll keep my eye on the clock. We'll have a 24-minute session, of course, for the first half, and you don't need to worry about it, I'll let you know. For the first half, what I'd like you to do, what I'm inviting you to do, is return to mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing. And whatever works best for you. You know, so you have the three modes, you have four modes. You have the kind of the Dzogchen approach. You have just full-on Shantideva style, full-body awareness. You have the Burmese style, rise and fall of the abdomen. Classic Theravada style, the sensations of the breath at the apertures of the nostrils, but with this emphasis, whatever the method you choose, with this emphasis, big time, big emphasis, relaxation. Really see if you can be more relaxed than ever before. Just deeply, deeply, deeply. Take advantage of every single out-breath. Never to push, never to kind of draw out, but just, again, like a glass that's fallen over and all the water spills out. Just release it, but every out-breath, don't miss a beat. You only have a finite number of breaths per lifetime. So let's not waste any of them now. As you're breathing out, that total release. And breath comes in a very gentle rise, just to keep, maintain that, the clarity with which you began. But just utterly emphasis on relaxation. And from the relaxation, a sense of calm, of composure, of quiet, peace and quiet. First half, 12 minutes. Yeah. Second one, we're going to go right to space, beyond sky, which actually you can look at, it's blue, I checked, you know. And I was wondering, but I think I know the answer, if you tried to, number one, how would you know if you took a photo of the just blue sky, how would you know whether it's in focus or out of focus? How would you know? If there are no clouds, if it's just a clear blue sky, how would you know whether it's in focus or not? And my answer is I don't know. But I'm going to assume that, well, number one, we can look at the sky. We can see the clear blue sky. Oh, look how beautiful blue it is. Look how blue. I can see the sky is blue. Okay, fine, but not space. Space is not blue. And so we're going to go into the second practice. It's going to be space. It's non-meditation. So please find a very comfortable posture. As for balancing earth, you're so familiar with it, you hardly need any instruction at all. So I'll simply say, settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state. And then with an emphasis on relaxing more and more deeply, simply without losing the clarity with which you began, choose the method of mindfulness of breathing, and let's practice that for the first half of this session. Then release your engagement with the breath and with any other object or appearance. And ever so simply let your awareness rest right where it is, without deliberately attending to any appearance to the mind by way of any of the six sense doors, without any interest in any appearances at all, without deliberately looking at them, and without inverting the awareness. In other words, do not look outwards or inwards, do not look, just be present. Without activating this mind of a sentient being in any way, thus without doing anything, without desiring anything, without striving for anything, and without seeking to modify the mind or awareness in any way. Simply be present without doing anything, and be present without letting your awareness be distracted or weighed to any appearance of any kind, and without grasping onto any impulse that arises from the sight of the subject. Whenever you note retrospectively that you're no longer doing the practice because your awareness has been carried away, it's not a matter of repairing the practice, but recommencing it. And you recommence it, begin it again, by relaxing, releasing whatever captivated your attention, and returning to the not doing at the present moment. If, on the other hand, you retrospectively note that you're just sitting there with a blank mind or spacing out, not really cognizing anything, then once again it's not a matter of doing the practice incorrectly. You're not doing it at all. So restart the practice by taking a fresh interest in this practice of non-meditation. Restore your awareness, resting effortlessly in the present moment. And retain, not doing anything. Simply rest there. And let's continue practicing now for the rest of the session in silence. Awesome. So I anticipate finishing the chapter this afternoon. I'd like to make some very brief comments, just straight in terms of Dzogchen of different lineages, just to get that sense of how do you say, diversity, malleability, non-rigidity. You know? And so, as you very well know here, it's laid out so clearly. We haven't seen it, but extensive teachings on the preliminary practices, very extensive, whole book, I think. And then you know the progress, so I don't need to reiterate it, but very clearly here, shamatha, vipassana. And then we have this identification. Let's just linger there for a moment. Identification, you know what that is, that pointing out that first glimpse, that first taste of viewing reality from the perspective of pristine awareness. That's the Dzogchen view. It's really simple. The Dzogchen view is viewing reality from the perspective of pristine awareness. That's all. It's nothing more to it than that. And so meditation, as Jujim Lingpo, Padmasambhava says so clearly, Dzogchen meditation is nothing other than sustaining the view. Dropping into that view, into that perspective, your coarse mind having dissolved, vanished, substrate consciousness cut through, and Dzogchen meditation is nothing other than simply sustaining that view, that perspective on reality, from pristine awareness. And so that chapter that we've almost finished, maybe I should make this afterwards, but it'll be fine. This, if we draw this strongest parallel among all the analogies that are given in the Dzogchen tradition, this is very much like being in the midst of a non-lucid dream and having a companion who shows up in the dream who teaches you how to become lucid. So one of my students is quite rather good at lucid dreaming. He said he was in the midst of a non-lucid dream and somebody appeared to him, and the person who appeared, he just said, "Do you know this is a dream?" And that was enough. Then he became lucid, right? And so that may be enough. That's the person that's called, if we go back to Devadra essence, what? Simultaneous. Do you know this is a dream? Oh, good, you do. Good, I'm finished. And then you just skip shamatha and vipassana, and you just rest, since your mind is simply dissolved in pristine awareness, then you have only one task to do. Good, stay there. And let that experience deepen, deepen, deepen until you're a vidyadhara, right? So, but some people may need a bit more than that, you know? And so then this companion of yours in the non-lucid dream may give you a bit more than just saying, you know, this is a dream, or wake up, or hit you with a sandal. In which case, he or she might say, well, why don't you try just merging your mind with space for a while and see what happens? Maybe that will be enough. Where you have that whole sense of just instantly, just like in that instant, you know, nirvana is giving everything away, just releasing your mind. Just that, release, and see what's left. And that may be enough. You may go right into Rigpa, then skip shamatha, skip vipassana, rest in Rigpa. Really simple, very straightforward, right? So there's that. Now, there's that approach. Now there's approach, I translated an entire text. It's one of these incredibly concise and complete texts from the Pema Lingpa lineage, the great Tetun of Bhutan. I've received teachings from one of the principal lamas of that whole lineage. He is an emanation of Pema Lingpa. Translated the whole text. I won't give away many secrets here, but I will say there were fairly extensive teachings on preliminary practices, including very nice, beautiful presentation of the Four Immeasurables. No teachings on shamatha or vipassana. Goes directly from preliminary practice right into tekchur, and then into tekel, and you're finished. So for some people, clearly, that's been around for hundreds of years now. People don't preserve something. I mean, sensible people don't preserve something. It doesn't work. They say, oh, we have a lot of dharma. You know, there's so much richness there. If something just isn't working, then, well, you know, I think I won't teach it. You know, teach something else that does work. So there's an approach. How about that one? And I asked the Lama, you know, where's shamatha? He said, there's no shamatha. Which is to say, of course there's shamatha. You can't achieve enlightenment without shamatha, but you may get it by your mind dissolving into Rigpa, and Rigpa is the wellspring of all virtues. You just get shamatha right out of Rigpa, and you get insight into emptiness out of Rigpa. If you're lucid in a dream, if you're really, really lucid in a dream, you know that everything in the dream, objectively and subjectively, doesn't exist from its own side. That's what it means to be lucid, that you know, right? It's not really there. It's a dream. And you're not really here, whoever this persona is in the dream, you're not really here either, right? So that may be enough. Now, Lerab Lingpa, I've translated his whole text too. Had a lot of, you know, spare time. And so that was a whole text. I received the empowerment for that as well. And Lerab Lingma, one of the confidants, a Dzogchen master for the 13th Dalai Lama, lays out the preliminaries, Remy, quite exquisite, I have to say, with the seventh of the common preliminaries being subtly in the mind is natural state, goes through uncommon preliminaries with no reference to numbers, 10,000, 100,000, he says, do it until you get the realization. Then he goes stage of generation, completion, Tekshu and Trutgel, with no reference to Vipassana. Vipassana is not there. Interesting, yeah? But you can pick up Shamatha within stage regeneration. You can pick it up within Tekshu. It may just come right out, right? And then we know Jujum Lingpa, in his five treatises, he makes only either no reference or very brief reference to preliminary practices, except for the core essential teachings of the three common and the three uncommon. They're there for sure, right? But that's it. And then every single one of them, except for Buddhahood without meditation, but that's not complete. It doesn't have the direct crossing over. There's no Trutgel there. But in all of those that cover Tekshu and Trutgel, you have Shamatha Vipassana, Tekshu, Trutgel, and then you're complete. Then it's rainbow body. So it just kind of shows, it should make all of us relax a bit, you know, and just recognize that in this world with this diverse sentient beings, there are some who will be find this most suitable, and this most suitable, and this most suitable, and each one of them can come to its fruition. Oh, so this is identification chapter, right? And that's really all about become lucid. I mean, just become lucid. It's a real discontinuity. It's a fundamental shift of axis on your experience that you're now viewing it from not a sentient being's mind, but from pristine awareness, right? But then what's your, in lucid dreaming, then what? What? If you just become lucid, what? Relax, stabilize, and clarify. Learn how to maintain it. Learn how to stay lucid. It's very easy to get excited and then wake up. It's also not that hard to be lucid and then lose it and go right back to a non-lucid dream. That's very easy to do. So your practice, once you've identified, once you become lucid, then stay lucid. And then you may start investigating the nature of that reality, right? Now, if you want to, again, it's a beautiful analogy. If you're in a non-lucid dream and somebody just says, do you know this is a dream? Your response might be, no, it isn't. And that might be the end of the conversation. What are you, stupid? Of course it's not a dream. And you might come and punch them, you know, to prove your point. Because if I'm a dream, then this wouldn't hurt, would it? You know. And so that person might then say, oh, sorry, my mistake. By the way, where were you born? Ever been asked that when you were in a dream? Where were you born? It's like pigeons. Has anybody ever seen a baby pigeon? Aren't they born full-fledged? I mean, I've seen thousands of pigeons and I've never seen a baby. I kind of think maybe they're just spontaneously arisen. Maybe they don't come. They just come out and they come with all those germs that pigeons carry. Mm. But it's very weird about pigeons. Okay, I'm not going to elaborate on that one. But it's very strange. You know, I've seen so many pigeons and never a baby. Not one baby. They just, you know, like spontaneous. Okay. If somebody asks you, where were you born in a dream? And they say, and you say, I can't remember. Isn't that a bit strange? What was your childhood like? You can't remember? Are you still sure you're not dreaming? What was your youth like? Where were you a year ago? You still can't remember? How many questions do I have to ask? Before it dawns on you, maybe you're not here at all. And by the way, where is here? Especially if you had a guide in the dream that could go and have you be 1,000 miles away in a moment, which is very easy in a dream. Right? You can instantaneously be someplace else. So where are you? Where are you right now? When you can snap your fingers and be someplace else, where are you? And then when you went there, where did you go? So origin, location, destination, that's a good way to wake up. And that's exactly the questions here, to wake up. When did you become a sentient being? You're so confident. You're a Buddha. He says, no, I'm not. Oh, okay. Sorry, my mistake. When did you become a sentient being? When exactly did that happen? What were the early days as a sentient being? Where did you grow up as a sentient? Where were you a little kid sentient being, as opposed to the mature, totally screwed up sentient being you are now? You know. So you can see it's all going to the same point. The same point. Some people get it quickly. Some people need to go back to shamatha and get the mind to just calm down, because it's so screwed up it can't do anything well. And that's why shamatha is there. So now let's make hay while the sun shines. Back to the text. Identification, how to become lucid in the waking state. Back to page 118, this marvelous teacher, Kachit Wombo, who had us in stitches the other day, is so funny, but so profound. This is the early incarnation of Jigme Dorje Rinpoche, I think 16th century, something like that. So here we go. And by the way, I was reading through this again this afternoon, that again, these are just scintillating, pointing out instructions. So as I'm just giving the transmission here, and that's what you are receiving, if we're just going to read through it, but if one of these, this one or one of the ones that to come, if it really just kind of draws you, really like, whoa, that was deep, I really encourage you. You know, we'll be gone in 2 weeks. We won't be here anymore. And I would really encourage you, at your leisure, tape it and give yourself pointing out instructions. And then you do it exactly the way you like it. 24-minute session, 30-minute, an hour. Make it just exactly the way you would like it. And let Kachit Wombo give you the pointing out instructions. This is quite brilliant. Let's read. O child of the family, if your present mind were something existent, if it were really there, it would have to be outside, inside, or in between. It has to be somewhere. Is it truly there? And by the way, where is there if it is there? Colors and shape may not appear, but if you think you are simply aware of appearances, if you think that's all there is, it's just appearances, what awareness knows that awareness? This is very current. You know, these highly intelligent people who say consciousness doesn't exist, they're just objects, they're just brain, they're just phenomenon, physical entity. I mean, intelligent people saying this. They're saying this, awareness doesn't exist. It's just the world and the brain, physical, right? Okay, and then you could ask, you could echo Kachit Wombo and say, very interesting, but how is it you know that? Interesting question. And that's exactly what he asked. If you think there are only appearances, only the physical, only objects, good. What is it just came to that conclusion? Which object was it that just came to that conclusion? It's very sharp. What awareness knows that awareness? That you just said there are only appearances. If you think it is aware of any object, this mind, is that object other than that awareness? Or is it the same? So we see some very hardcore, very sharp Vipassana questions here. When it indivisibly appears to the mind, that is the appearances, what is known and observed in the mind? If it were the ultimate reality of the mind, it would be like the blade of a sword cutting itself. That is, if the mind can observe itself, then, okay, like the blade cutting the blade. How could that be so? Everything, including enemies, friends, attractive and unattractive things, is just like that. Therefore, calling awareness consciousness is just a designation. It's so easy to dodge, you know, the question. What's the nature of awareness? Well, you know, consciousness. As if you just added some information and all you did was make a noise. It is explored and analyzed. If it is explored and analyzed, it's like that. Ta-ta-ta. It's like that. However, you may think it is evidently empty, nowhere to be found, when you cognize, know, and realize it is like this. At the time of realizing, knowing, and cognizing, it is certainly unestablished. Not something you can nail down. Thus, until now, you've been distracted by grasping the absence of awareness, or that which is not awareness, as awareness, the absence of consciousness as consciousness, the absence of mind, that which is not the mind, as the mind. That happens every single day all over the world nowadays, right? Brain, behavior, blah, blah, blah. They're finding all kinds of interesting things, and then just calling that the mind, and then saying, mission accomplished. You know, exactly like George Bush. Mission accomplished. Now we're finished. Except there was no mission that was accomplished at all. It was just an empty gesture. So just that sentence again. Thus until now you've been distracted by grasping. The absence of awareness is awareness. The absence of consciousness is consciousness. The absence of mind is mind. The absence of cognition is cognition. And the absence of realization, because you don't know what you're talking about, but you have the illusion of knowledge thinking you do. That's the worst kind of ignorance, is where you think you already know something, that you don't. But do you understand? He's very sharp. O child of the family, this mind is like space. Can space be established as being this? Likewise, the mind is like the color of space, like the horn of a hare. It is unestablished, rootless, without basis, undemonstrable, without intrinsic nature, signless, lacking characteristics or marks, colorless, shapeless, devoid of an essence of its own, not arising, not departing, and not remaining. It is by its very nature uncompounded. So even the omniscient one has not seen it, does not see it, and will not see it. If it were even slightly established, just a little bit really there, the omniscient one would see it. But since it is not the slightest bit established, it is not seen. Have you taken to heart this ascertainment of reality? Until now you have succumbed to negating and affirming by grasping onto the mind, cognition, consciousness, likes and dislikes, joys, sorrows, delusion and liberation, the pure and impure, the best and the worst, good and bad and the like. But the mind is not observed. How can it be observed? Leave it in the state of your non-existent mind. Leave it in the state of no thinking. Leave it in the state of no negation or affirmation. Leave it in the state of no rejection or acceptance. Leave it in the state of no hopes or fears. Leave it in the state of no is or is not. Leave it in the state of no good or bad. Leave it in the state of no delusion or liberation. No delusion, no liberation. We're going right back to the flight of the Garuda. Before the even terms of Nirvana and Samsara emerge, go back there. Because that's the view of Samatabhadra. So he pointed so vividly. I don't know how that could be said more clearly. To a dimension of awareness that is beyond all conceptual frameworks. And if you try to bring your conceptual frameworks to it, you'll never get there. Too much baggage. And now a really juicy one from the same text. This is from Natural Liberation, from Padmasambhava. Orgyen Rinpoche says, this, again, I just have to say, brilliant pointing out instructions. And such clear discernment. Watch what he has to say here. Oh, once you have calmed the compulsive thoughts in your mind right where they are, and the mind is unmodified, isn't there a motionless stability? Oh, this is called shamatha. But it is not the nature of the mind. It's a good step, though. But now what? Now steadily observe the very nature of your own mind that is being still. Again, it's being still, and then it's not being still. Still, not still. That one, yeah? Examine the nature of that one. That is being still for a while. Is there a resplendent emptiness that is nothing, that is unestablished in the nature of any substance, shape, or color? That is called the empty essence, the essential nature of the mind, which is emptiness of inherent nature. So in the first one, he said it's not the nature of the mind. What he's saying, it's not the ultimate nature of the mind. But, as Padmasambhava says in the Vajra essence, as Penchen Rinpoche says in his treatise on Mahamudra, it is the relative nature of the mind. It's luminous and cognizant, good, but it's not the ultimate nature of the mind. For that, okay, probe inwards, vipassana. And then you see its empty essence, that's the ultimate nature of the mind, empty of inherent nature. Right. Don't stop. Isn't there a luster of that emptiness, not a mere vacuity? Isn't there a luster of that emptiness that is unceasing, clear, immaculate, soothing, and luminous, as it were? This as it were, it's a very close translation, in a manner of speaking, because of course none of these words capture it. You could know nothing whatsoever about pristine awareness and know what each of those terms means. Immaculate, that's new fallen snow. Soothing, that's a massage. Luminous, a 1,000-watt bulb. You know, these are all terms that we use, and they use as well. And so it's going beyond the ordinary meaning of the term. It's pointing to and not describing, as it were. It's like almost like poetry. It's kind of like luminous. It's kind of like soothing. It's kind of like, you know, as it were. But it's beyond anything you've ever known. That unceasing, clear, immaculate, soothing luminosity, that is called the luminous nature. That's the manifest nature, ranjin. The empty nature, ngoje, essential nature. But this manifest nature, its essential nature, is the indivisibility of sheer emptiness, not established as anything. There's the emptiness aspect, and its unceasing vivid luster. Such awareness is resplendent and brilliant, as it were. Again, jewelry can be resplendent. The sun on a very hot day is brilliant. But, well, as it were. This present unmoving consciousness, which cannot be directly expressed in words, that is, it's by nature ineffable. However, whatever language you speak, however incredibly eloquent you may be, it will never be captured in words. It's by nature ineffable. It cannot be directly expressed in words. Even if you're a Buddha, you can't. This is given the name, that which is inexpressible is given the name. You see the wonderful irony? Awareness. That which thinks is this alone, so it is given the name mind. It is this that is mindful of all kinds of things. This is the Supreme Sovereign, right? The all-creating Sovereign. So it is given the name mindfulness. While it is not seen, it is a special seeing that is clear, steady, unmediated, and steadfast. So it is given the name vipassana. It is that that makes distinctions among all specific phenomena, like separating the layers of a mushroom. So it is given the name discerning wisdom. All terms such as Sugatagarbha, the soul bindu, absolute space, primordial consciousness, the middle way, ultimate truth, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, and emptiness are names of this alone. They're all pointing in the same direction. The next one again, hold your breath. Well, don't hold your breath, but attend closely. This is really quite breathtaking, so breathe naturally and drink this in. Pointing out the Dharmakaya, of course, pristine awareness, pointing out instructions, here it comes. Now, all objective appearances are like water and waves. All are apparitions of the mind, and in reality are unestablished. By realizing this, one realizes all appearances as the mind. By analyzing the essence of the mind, in terms of going, staying, and arising, it turns out not to be established as anything. So like horses and elephants in a dream, it is unestablished in reality. By realizing this, one recognizes that the mind is empty. From the state of emptiness, clarity, and lucidity, in unceasing great joy, it spontaneously arises as manifold appearances, like the moon's reflections in water. By realizing this, one recognizes emptiness as spontaneous actualization. Thus, from simple spontaneous actualization, arising and release occur spontaneously, without wavering from immutable great bliss that is clear, empty, spontaneous and free of elaboration, like a snake that unravels its own knots. By ascertaining this, one recognizes spontaneous actualization as self-liberating. Continuing from the same text, the mind that is recognized is ordinary consciousness that disperses in various ways, vividly knowing all kinds of things. That is clarity and emptiness united, great bliss, emptiness bearing all supreme aspects, and Mahamudra. Knowing its essence is called realization of Mahamudra. So without having anything on which to meditate, without being distracted even for an instant, settle your awareness in clarity. Without fostering any hope for a good outcome or fear about a bad outcome, be at ease. By sustaining the essence of ordinary consciousness, in that moment, the Mahamudra union of bliss and emptiness is seen like the state of pure space free of clouds. Now shamatha and vipassana are integrated. Extraordinary experiential realization arises, and you succeed in entering the path of liberation. You come to the first yoga, the yoga of single-pointedness. So now a short and very quintessential conversation between Atisha and his principal disciple, Domdumba. The questions and answers between Lord Atisha and Domdumba states, Venerable One, so obviously it's Domdumba, the disciple, previous incarnation of the Dalai Lama. Venerable One, asking Atisha, who is a previous incarnation of the Penchen Rinpoche. Venerable One. What a conversation, right? Venerable One, I repeatedly seek it, but I do not find it. Dom, you repeatedly see your own nature. Venerable One, should I rest in not finding? Dom, it's best to set yourself at ease. I would love to have known him. A teacher like that, I'd like to. Well, I do have teachers like that. I do, actually. Jigten Sumgun, I checked him out. He's the founder of the Dikun Kagyu. It's one of the lineages within Gagyupa. Dikun Kagyu. Shamba Kagyu, Gama Kagyu, Dupa Kagyu, Dikun Kagyu. He was the founder of that. He was a disciple, principal disciple of Pakmo Dupa. And he was one of the three principal disciples of Gampopa. But Gampopa was one of the two principal disciples of Milarepa. Milarepa to Marpa, Marpa to Naropa, Naropa to Tilopa, Tilopa to Saraha. You don't need to go further than that. So Jigten Sumgun, extraordinary lama, very great, centuries ago, I think it was 13th century. But what's interesting here is how timeless this is. You would not have a clue. As a translator, I don't have a clue whether they're writing from the 16th century, the 19th century, the 13th century. The Tibetan's more or less the same, and the meaning is exactly the same. If it works, you don't fix it. If you found the key, you just keep on opening the door. And that's what's happened for hundreds of years now. This doesn't need improvement. What it can be done, and what I am seeking to do, is bring it into the present moment. So we don't have to pretend that we're in the 13th century, which we're not, for better or worse. So Jigten Sumgun says, when you look at your ongoing clear awareness, you see nothing. That is seeing thatness. Ta-ta-ta. The point is that now to Kamachamet, and he wraps it up. But he's given us such a bouquet here, extraordinary bouquet. The fragrance is delicious. The point is that the continuous stability of the mind without scattering is shamatha. By looking at its essence, now that you've settled in the subject consciousness, then looking at it, inverting it, probing into that, which is now settled. You've come down to naked sentient being's mind, right? Without elaboration, without male, female, ethnicity, and so forth. You got it. You have it naked, like no skin, just naked. So go in, penetrate. By looking at its essence, there is vipassana into emptiness. Such that upon the basis of stability, vipassana arises. If the mind is not the slightest bit stable, it is not seen. So the observation of the various scatterings of the mind is the observation, the stable observation of the various scatterings of the mind is shamatha. By looking at its essence, one sees it is empty. Thus insight or vipassana arises on the basis of dispersion. By seeing the empty nature of all that flows out of the mind. In the Dharmakaya space of the non-conceptual mind, if the mass of clouds of ideation is not cleared away, the sun and moon of the two kinds of knowledge will not shine forth. This is very, very dense. The two kinds of knowledge are jine kenpe yeshe, dang jita wa kenpe yeshe. Jita wa kenpe yeshe, this primordial consciousness of knowing things as they are, knowing reality as it is. Jita wa, just as it is. That's knowing emptiness. Jine zikpe yeshe. Jine zikpe yeshe is a primordial consciousness that sees the full range of phenomena, the diversity of phenomena, the six realms, the whole shebang, everything. Those are the two. Those are the two aspects of Buddha's mind. Knowing emptiness, knowing the full range of phenomena. Well, if you don't have, how do you say? If the clouds of ideation, if you haven't achieved shamatha, that's not going to happen. Because your mind is just a garbage dump. It's all scattered. You can't use it. It's like a car that's broken. So assiduously apply yourself to this primordial meditation. So that's that. This completes the identification of awareness. May there be virtue. And indeed, may there be so. So, that was to the 17th century. And a bit of background. Very briefly, 20th century, and I'm going to go through it quickly, quite quickly. Where we're coming from, where we're familiar, where we're at home, is a context, an intellectual context, where we know what religion is, we know what philosophy is, we know what science is. This can be very brief. I'm not going to elaborate. But this is the air we breathe. We hear something and we immediately wonder, is that a religion? Is that a philosophy? Is it science? What is it? I need to place it. I need to make sense of this. Where's this coming from? And so I would suggest religious beliefs characteristically are based on divine authority, without necessarily relying on logical reasoning or empirical evidence. It says in this book, the Buddha said, the Tao Te Ching it says, and that's it. Okay, I believe. That's your religion. That's characteristic, isn't it? These are our terms. These are not Buddhist terms at all. You won't find a word like this. There's no word for religion in Sanskrit or Tibetan. But we certainly know what it's like. And what I just said, I think, is very sensible. That didn't startle you, did it? Philosophy. Philosophical speculations, all those marvelous ideas, sometimes incredibly smart. Philosophical speculations are derived using logical reasoning. If you don't know how to do that, you're not a philosopher. You have to know logic. You have to think clearly. They're speculations, they're derived using logical reasoning without necessarily lending themselves to empirical corroboration or repudiation. They just throw it out and see whether you believe them or not, you want to debate. But just by nature, philosophical do not lend themselves to empirical confirmation, otherwise they might actually get some answers that are incontrovertible. But they don't, which means they debate endlessly. Now, in contrast to those, scientific theories are based on empirical evidence and logical reasoning, often mathematical, and they do a scientific theory. I will insist on this point. I think it's a nice point to insist on. I'm not argumentative, but if you're calling something a scientific theory and not simply a philosophical speculation or religious belief, then that theory must lend itself to empirical corroboration or repudiation. If you can't test it in any way, why are you calling it a scientific theory, let alone a scientific fact? That's the strength of the last 400 years. They come up theories, some of them are proven wrong, some are proven right, you know? So I'm drawing that distinction. Now we go to Buddhism. Okay, some really core Buddhist ideas. Buddhism includes three things. Assertions pertaining to what are called very hidden phenomena, Shintokokyu. Very hidden phenomena that can be corroborated, you can know them, only by way of a Buddha, who is viewed as, that is, such a thing as the subtlety of karma, the qualities of a Buddha's mind, things like that. These can be corroborated only by a Buddha. If you're a Buddha, then you can say, yes, it's true, got it, you know. And Buddha is viewed as a divine authority, even in Theravada. I mean, really, the gods worshipped him. How could he be anything less than divine when Brahma and Indra are worshipping him? You know, so Buddha is regarded as divine. For the last 2,500 years, now a lot of people are looking for secular Buddhism, which is fine. So, corroborated only a Buddha who is viewed as a divine authority, so their validity is known by inference based on authority. That is, you may know it, but it's inference based on authority. We've discussed that, I won't elaborate. That's one category, very, very hidden. The subtleties of karma, the quality of a Buddha's mind, and so forth. Don't try to figure it out, don't look for imperial, it's it's beyond you. You're not up to it. You have to be a Buddha, and then you can. Until then, you can believe it or not believe it, but you, or you can really investigate and get inference based on authority, but you won't get it with logic or just looking at appearances. Secondly, there are assertions in Buddhism pertaining to slightly hidden phenomena, the truth of which can be known using logical reasoning, sound inference, dialectical training, debate, can be known, right? So the first one, by the way, sounds like religion. This one sounds like philosophy. And then there are assertions in Buddhism pertaining to evident phenomena, the truth of which can be known with direct perception, including mental and yogic perception, neither of which is even acknowledged in the modern world. They don't have a word for either one. Yoga perception, forget about it. They don't even have mental perception. I took a whole course on cognitive psychology, a 500-page textbook, and they never mentioned that you can actually perceive mental events. Incredibly bizarre. Incredibly bizarre. It was like, you know, having sight and taking a course in art history where they never talk about anything other than shades of gray. It was bizarre. And I got to the end of the textbook, and I was a graduate student taking an undergraduate course, and I asked my professor, I don't really want to take your exam. Would you allow me just to write a critique of the textbook? All she could say is no, right? She said, go for it. I did. I ripped the textbook. I just ripped it. She gave me an A+. And I think she probably continued to use the same textbook. So, evident phenomena can be ascertained with direct perception, including mental perception, yogic perception, which you get through shamatha vipassana. Progress along the path to enlightenment entails progression from the first inference based on authority to the second inference based on logic to the third, directly knowing. That's the whole movement. That you start out religious, you become philosophical, and you finally wind up being scientific. The limits of thoughts. I found this very interesting. It just kind of popped up. I feel like, you know, one of my ancestors was one of the guys who came from the East Coast in the 1840s looking for gold in California. Must have been very courageous and very stupid. You know, because hardly any of them struck gold. But I come from there. But it really struck me, you know, I saw a documentary on this. These poor guys, they're going through enormous hardships, like Milarepa-style hardships. I mean, I'm serious. Milarepa-style hardships. Incredible. And all they're after is gold. Milarepa was after enlightenment. Okay, anything would be fine. They're after gold. And what do? They sit in this freezing cold water up to their waist and going through sand. Just sand and sand and dirt and rocks and sand and and hopefully they'll be able to get a nugget, you know, hopefully they get a big nugget. So when I'm checking out the internet, I'm standing waist deep in the cold water of the internet and I pull out nuggets. These are my nuggets. There's an awful lot of sand. So if I have any skill, it's knowing how to find the nuggets, recognize them when I see them. Here are some nuggets from the Pali Canon. The Buddha himself identified four imponderables, imponderables being samgimikappa, things that you cannot conceive the answer. Don't bother asking the question. You'll never, ever get it in a trillion years with your conceptual mind. If you do, you'll be vexed and miserable and go insane. Something like that, he said. So just recognize there's some things that you're not up to it, kiddos. Hello, sentient beings, you're not up to it. What's very interesting, see what he says, four. Ready? Samgimikappa jire. Ninja washustu. So, the first one. The range of powers a Buddha develops as a result of becoming a Buddha. So, come up to the Buddha. Buddha, tell me about your mind. I'd like to figure it out. What are your powers? What you got? Well, don't vex yourself. Your sentient being minds will never get around it. You'll never, ever fathom it. He could speak for 1,000 years, you could learn everything, and you still won't get, you won't even be 1 inch closer in terms of really comprehending. You won't. So don't try. Become a Buddha, then you won't have to ask the question. But until then, you're not going to get it. That's the first one. But it's, of course, it's ponderable for a Buddha, and two Buddhas can come together. How's it to be omniscient? Good. Good for you. Good for me too. That's the conversation, you know. No problem. You know, Om Ahum. Gotcha. They have no problem at all. You know, they can just say pet. Yeah, pet to you. Not a problem. But if you're anything less than a Buddha, you're not going to get it, right? But the next one's so interesting. In these imponderables, the range of powers that one can may obtain while absorbed in jhana. That, you didn't see that coming, did you? The range of powers, the ngudup, that you get through achieving jhanas. Well, if you've achieved jhanas, those are not imponderable at all. You know exactly what's coming up. But if you're still there in the desire realm, and jhana is kind of some hypothetical abstract, then it's inconceivable. You will not know. What's it like to have these modes of clairaudience, clairvoyance, these powers and powers that you get just from the jhanas in form realm, let alone formless realm? You cannot imagine it. Doesn't matter how hard you try. Doesn't matter if you're an Einstein or Roger Penrose. You won't get it. You're not up to it. But if you want to get it, then achieve jhanas. But there is no other way. That's the second one. Very interesting. Here's the third one. The precise working out of the results of karma. Okay, do something. Give a person a nice birthday present. What's the karma from that? How does that manifest? When do the ripples stop rippling? The karmic repercussions of that. And exactly how are they going to work out? There's no way you can ever figure it out. You have to be a Buddha for that. So once again, the subtle workings of karma, don't even try. Get the broad strokes, get the patterns, be good, live according to the laws. But in terms of thinking you can figure it out, don't even try. And then the last one, the origin of the cosmos. It's always been true. The Christians have never been able to figure it, the Christians, Jews, and so forth. Why did God do it? Why did he do it? Why didn't he do it this way? Exactly what did he do? If you're a theist, you don't have an answer. If you're a non-theist, ask any physicist, what exactly happened at t equals zero, time equals zero, the Big Bang? What was that like? You get this resounding silence. They don't have a clue. And by the way, what happened just before? And why did it happen then and not 3 years earlier? Why not 3 billion plus 3 years? Or 3.7 billion plus 3 years? Or a billion? Or what's 100 million among friends? Why then? I mean, it's a good question. Why then? Why not just 5 billion years ago? Why not yesterday? Why then? What happened 3.7, 3.8 billion years ago that it happened then? And it's just resounding silence. Imponderable. Okay, now let's play. So that was interesting, wasn't it? Core Buddhism. No tangents here. Okay, I want to do some fun things now, though. That we're very familiar with. Have you ever been just sitting quietly, maybe following your breath, and then after some time, you retrospectively note that you've lost your mind, that you've been wandering, and you're actually not following your breath at all? Does ring a bell? Okay. What was the first moment, the first mind moment, that very first instant of your mind wandering? And maybe it went on for 5 seconds, maybe 10, maybe longer, right? But tell me, what was the first instant like? That very first moment, you're on the breath, and then you're not, right? Sometimes, then you're not. What's that very first moment of this vikalpa namdo, this wandering mind? What was that first moment like? When you were born into that wandering thought, what was that like? Well, I would suggest you can't remember, ever. Because in that first moment, if you recognized it, you wouldn't be wandering. Therefore, by definition, if it's truly this vikalpa, this just wandering mind, you'll know it so well, if it's that type of thought, where you lost your mind, you're never aware of the first moment, because if it were, it wouldn't be the first moment. It would be just one more continuity of settling the mind as natural state. Hello, thought. Glad to meet you. You just came through the front door. Hi. 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 Yep. You didn't see it coming. The first moment, you don't know. You're unaware of it. Therefore, you can't remember it. You can't remember something you never knew in the first place. Isn't it kind of obvious? You just listen to the words. You can't remember something you never knew in the first place. So there's little mini, mini cosmos. Okay, now let's take one step further. You're just hanging out there in that beautiful symmetry of stage 3 or stage 4 deep sleep, non-REM sleep, just zonked. You're not aware of anything explicitly. And then, after some time, you're in the midst of you find yourself in a non-lucid dream. Right? It happens, right? It happens every night. And at some point, it could happen that in the midst of a non-lucid dream, you become lucid. It could happen. It does happen. Good, so once you're still in the dream, and you just become lucid, this is a dream, go ahead, remember the first moment of the dream. If you could remember the first moment of the dream, which means you remember the first moment of the dream as a dream, then it wouldn't be a non-lucid dream. It would be a lucid dream, in which case you would know it exactly. If you were lucid in the substrate, and you aroused your mind, and you catalyzed dreams such that in the very first moment you're lucid, because you were lucid already, and then you come into a dream lucid, you would know exactly when that happened. But if that first moment is non-lucid, then you don't know you're dreaming, which means you can't remember that moment, the first moment of dreaming, because you were unaware that it was a dream at the time. You can't remember something that you never knew in the first place. So we have two. You see what's coming. And then we have the first moment of a wandering non-lucid mind, the first moment of a wandering non-lucid dream, and then we have the first moment of a wandering non-lucid rebirth. Because that's what we're experiencing right now, a non-lucid rebirth. I mean, unless you're a vidyadhara, this is a non-lucid rebirth. We don't recognize this for what it is. We're taking it for something it's not. Like there are real people out there, and this is really me over here, and there's real dualistic grasping. So when was the first moment? When was the first moment of this rebirth? When was the first moment of being this person you are now? Exactly when did that happen? It did happen. I mean, you're not 70. So between 70 years ago and now, there was a first moment, and Rhonda, this was Rhonda's first moment. It has to be. She's not 70. So we don't need to get it closer than that. But sometime between now and 70 years ago, there was a first moment of Rhonda. Has to be. How could there not be? So what was that first moment like? And the answer, I think, from virtually all of us, I don't say all of us, but I think virtually all of us, is I wasn't aware of being reborn, and therefore I can't recall that which I never knew in the first place. Now, tulkus, if you're lucid in the bardo all the way through, you die lucidly. Like very likely this incredible yogi Chöden Rinpoche, who's just passed away. I think he's probably in the clear light right now. I don't know that, but he just passed away. Incredible yogi. So let's imagine that he's in the clear light of death right now. So he's lucid. His death was spectacular. You know. And then after some time, that tukdam, that final abiding in the clear light of death, will come to an end. Days, whatever it may be. He'll be in the bardo. Chances are he's going to be lucid in the bardo, exactly like a lucid dream. And then if he is so compassionate as to decide to come back here and give us another try, then he'll come back lucidly. He'll come back with compassion, with intention. He'll find where he wants to go. He'll go, and in that first moment, because he's coming, he's already lucid, in that first moment he's going to be lucid. So then he could recall his first moment, because he's lucid in that firmness. But people are simply thrown by their karma, as we're thrown into wandering thoughts, thrown into non-lucid dreams, and thrown into non-lucid rebirths, we're not aware of the first moment. And therefore we can't remember it. Which means from the perspective of being in a thought where maybe you've just become lucid, you're recognizing, I was, but now I know I am no longer. From that perspective, the first moment of that wandering thought is for you not maybe for a clairvoyant yogi or let alone for the Buddha, but it's for you, unknowable. You can't remember it because you never knew it in the first place. What was characteristic? What was it like? It's unknowable in principle because you can't remember that which you never knew in the first place. That which is unknowable in principle, we do not call existent. Do not attribute existence to that which is unknowable in principle. That's quantum mechanics and it's Buddhist epistemology. Luyu dja roma. If it's not fit to be an object of the mind, do not say that it's existent. Therefore, the first moment of your wandering mind has no beginning from your perspective. It didn't go on for eternity. It just has no beginning from your perspective. The first moment of a dream, of a non-lucid dream, you can't know it in principle. Even if you become lucid, you can't remember how it started. So for you, the first moment, there is no first moment. Your non-lucid dream has no beginning because it's not knowable. You cannot know something you never knew, and now it's too late. It happened 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes, whatever, but it's too late. You can't know it now. You could have if you'd been there at the time, but now it's too late. So for you, your dream is the beginning of your dream. Well, it has no beginning. It's unknowable. And likewise, this rebirth, all rebirths, we wind up being born out of unknowing. Therefore, the first moment of samsara is unknown and therefore unknowable. Therefore, there is no beginning to samsara. So that's a different spin. Microcosm, mid-range cosm, big cosm. If it's unknowable in principle, you cannot say it exists. So I draw from this, it's not necessarily the case that we've had literally an infinite number of past lives. Which never actually says that. Infinite, as in the mathematical notion of infinity, I've never seen it anywhere. At the same time, it doesn't mean finite either. Infinite is kind of conceivable, frankly. I mean, anybody studied math a bit, it's not inconceivable. They talk about it all the time. But if it's conceivable, then it's not that, because the Buddha said it's inconceivable. The origins of the universe, inconceivable. Maybe it's neither finite, neither infinite, and it can't be finite. Because if it's finite, then you ask what happened just before. Maybe it's just unknowable. And even if you're a Buddha who has just awakened, you also cannot recall that which you never knew in the first place. So even the Buddha says there's no beginning to samsara. Different spin on that. I thought that was fun. I got some doozies here, but not tonight. It's enough. 6 o'clock. So we'll continue a little bit with that. It'd be a nice segue, a nice bridge into the next chapter. So clearly there will be, if I am alive tomorrow at 4 o'clock, there will be an empowerment. If you're also alive, various causing conditions come together. And just one extremely brief comment on that regard, even as I'm packing up, it doesn't need my full attention. And that is, if there are those who I'm sure are quite clear, not the time, not the right time, not the right, clearly no, not now. That's excellent. It's good to have such clarity. Praiseworthy to have such clarity. Not now, for whatever reason, and you don't need to tell your reason to anybody. I'm not sure anybody really cares. That's fine, that's great. Clear, no, not now, fine. Or clear, definitely yes. That's also fine, they're equally fine. But there may be some people here in the room, or maybe some people listening by podcast, where there's still some unclarity, not quite sure. Maybe, but maybe not quite sure. If that lingers tomorrow, I have very clear advice. Better not to come. Really, clearly better not to come. When there's a lack of clarity, it's very clear. Better not to come. You won't regret it. And I just want to emphasize again, if I continue living, I'll very likely give this again. So no big deal, no rush. But let alone me, there are really quite a number of really qualified, some profoundly realized Dzogchen teachers of this lineage who will give this or some comparable empowerment. And it's not that rare. So if you have quite clarity, or you're uncertain, I think you can be quite clear. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. I may very well give it again, maybe many times, because I have very deep commitment to this lineage, this whole path. And if not me, that's not a problem. There are a number of really fine teachers out there, and they're not hard to find, and this type of empowerment is not difficult to find. So if you're uncertain, then relax happily and saying, then it's not a problem at all. But if you're still kind of uncertain, then what I would suggest is tonight, as you fall asleep, then call upon your yidam. Padmasambhava would be a good choice. Tara would be fine. Call upon your yidam, say, by tomorrow I'd like to have clarity. One way or another, I'd like to have clarity. And watch your dreams. Watch your dreams. Especially the last dream. The last dream before you wake up. Watch that. If there's nothing there, and you wake up with a lack of clarity, then you have perfect clarity. I'm not joking, I'm not playing with words. If you wake up with a lack of clarity, not quite sure, maybe not quite sure, that's your clarity. That your clarity is, there's a lack of clarity, and that's the answer. Don't come. No big deal. Really good not to come. You might have some dream. I had quite a remarkable dream this morning. It's my business, but it made it clear to me that it's really okay for me to give it tomorrow. Really, really clear. That doesn't mean anybody show up. That was not so clear. But that it'd be okay if I give it. That was really clear. I had really a wonderful dream this morning. Made me very happy. Okay, it's okay. That's all. That's all I'm going to say about that. So maybe if you don't have clarity when you fall asleep, maybe something will come up in your dream. And if there's no clarity, that's clarity. And if some clarity comes, that's clarity. Win-win. And you don't come, you win. That's good. Good decision. And if you do come with clarity, well, that's very good. I'll do my best for you. Okay? Whew. And the rest of you, not coming, have a nice Sunday. The rest of us are going to be a little bit busy tomorrow. So, very good. Good night, all.